Hello, everyone, and welcome.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. And now, during our Black Friday sale, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. Plus special financing. Limited time. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic.
All right, Nick, thanks so much, buddy.
Yeah, man, what's up?
Oh, no, this is amazing talking to you on this thing because, like, well, I don't know. I don't think we ever talked about how much I love Cold World. Have we talked about that before?
I don't think we talked about it.
You know about it, though, right? Like, word's gone back to
you. I know about it through various things, yeah.
Yeah, so I think you guys are, like, one of the most fascinating bands, and you're someone who is, a bit of a Svengali for the band in a lot of ways and stuff, but we'll get into all that later on. But I guess we're going to start off the way I start them all off, which is, how'd you get into punk?
I guess through skateboarding is like the easiest way.
Do you remember the first time you heard it though? Skateboarding, like in relation to skateboarding?
When I was listening to, your other podcast, the other ones, and, I was just thinking like when I was younger, it seemed like, I don't know, like, at least for me, it wasn't a point where I heard it and I was like, this is punk or this is hardcore and this is me. And then I'm not fucking with whack shit anymore because I was like super young. You know what I'm saying? So like, I already knew what punk and hardcore and stuff was when, you know, grunge was popping or Sepultura or whatever other stuff I was into, but I was super young, so I was still like not falling into the trap, but like still like getting into like whatever corny stuff was going on at the time as well. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's hard to say, like, you know, like I don't know. I know that like my first, like when I crossed over into like buying CDs, like some of my first CDs were like you would just get stupid shit, like, you know, because it maybe like, you know, it was on sale or something.
Did you ever do Columbia House or any of that?
Yeah, I did Columbia House. That was after a while though. So when I started getting CDs, I remember like I had like 24/7 Spies.
Yeah.
And then like, but I also had like the Spin Doctors. So like, so, but that was like way after I was already into stuff. So I remember like I had like one of the like weird early Anthrax records on CD, with the one with like the Sex Pistols cover. So I don't know, just like through stuff like that. And then like, you know, one of the first bands I really got into was Metallica. So like, you know, you'd see
Misfits and, you know, stuff, I guess.
Yeah, you'd see Misfits shirts and what else did they wear? Like GBH or, you know, whatever. And then you just go find out about it through there. And then just, you know, through skateboarding, like on the back of Thrash or whatever, there'd be like Sessions, mail order catalog.
Yeah. Did you ever order from there?
I ordered from some stuff. I don't think I – you know what I was into when I was a kid? I was into, like, getting free catalogs.
Yep.
And it's – oh, yeah. I haven't thought about this in a long time. Like, I had, like, weird catalogs come into my house. Like, because you would just – it would say, like, in, like, you know, like, CMJ magazine or whatever, like, weird magazines back there, like, you know, call for a free catalog. So I would be getting, like, catalogs from, like, Caroline Distribution and, like – Wax Tracks, like all this weird shit, like that I had almost no interest in, and like just so like I had like mad like it's so it's like all this was going on at the same time, so it's hard to like pinpoint like what the thing was, you know. So it's kind of hard, but
we used to order from Sessions, and it would be like double the price in shipping to Canada. It would be like insane, like $45 for a T-shirt, like. But it would be a sick Fugazi shirt for $45.
Hey, man, that sometimes that's how much it costs to tell the world that you're too drunk to fuck. When
exactly.
You're 14 years old, you know?
or buying the snot shirt because you think it's a Fugazi shirt.
Yeah. I definitely had the this is not a Fugazi shirt.
Yeah,
I had that. I got it from this place called Cheers. In the Wyoming Valley Mall in Wilkes-Barre.
my friend had that the this is not a Fugazi shirt. I always wanted though the Punk versus Raver SST shirt. Do you remember that one?
No, I don't remember that one. What was that?
It was like a short haired green haired punk dude punching a raver in the face. And I remember thinking that was the coolest shirt I'd ever seen.
Yeah,
little
that's pretty cool.
The reality was that if I had worn that, all the ravers that, you know, were legitimately probably much scarier and tougher than most of the punk people I knew would have beat the shit out of me. So
yeah,
it's for the best. I think
I couldn't wear it cause I was down with rave as well.
You
so
did.
I yeah.
Yo. So you, are you like, were you not straight edge at this point?
No, dude, I was always straight. I mean, you know, I wasn't,
you didn't identify. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was straight edge through everything, man. So I was into house music or drum and bass and going to weird raves or whatever and still straight edge and going to that shit alone because I was literally the only person I knew who was into that.
So that's crazy. So you've always been – because you have a very diverse musical palette. Like I think you know, a lot of times when I talk to people about Cold World, they would just assume mm-hmm. that you guys would listen to – bands like Cold World, but like, you know, I could talk to you about just about any genre of music. Have you so you've always been that way?
Yeah, for sure.
So where did that love of music come from? Was it like family or was it?
Yeah, my grandmother on my mom's side was a bluegrass musician.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah. So like I'd be around guitars and like stick boards, like sliding guitars, playing with those and stuff like that, like since I was like super young. So I was around that, and then like my uncle, my mom's brother, played drums and was like a badass, like, you know, like handed me down like my first like skateboard and like played like Two Live Crew for me and like handed me down like Metallica Kill 'Em All tape. So I would play on his drum set. It was like a clear blue Ludwig Vista light, which I really wish I still had. But yeah, so that's how I like got into music like that. And also I was an only child. So, you know, I was talking about this today with somebody I work with, like being an only child, like I know like every stupid sitcom and you know, like when you're an only child, you have time alone with yourself to like explore shit.
It's funny you say that because Jonah from Fucked Up's an only child too, and he's like, you know, very pop culturally versed, and you know, can play any instrument and very musically versed too. So yeah, maybe it's the time to kind of have that time to yourself to kind of study stuff.
Yeah, I could definitely see that, and even you know. Even still, like I love being alone and just being able to just like delve into shit. That's like my favorite time, man.
So is it kind of like right there that you start playing? I guess not formally, like, but you started playing right from a really young age. What age were you when you started like you know, I guess, getting into the scene, as it were?
My first show ever, I played snare drum in band. I was born in like the Wilkes-Barre area, but I like moved back and forth to Florida until middle school. So when I was in middle school in Florida, I played drums in like the not the marching band, just like this like band.
Yeah, like a jazz band type thing.
Yeah, I guess. Like I think I was in like what was supposed to become the marching band, but I moved back to Wilkes-Barre before I was old enough to be in the marching band. But the kid who was like maybe 2 years older than me, his name was Maz. He was like into like hip hop and cool shit. And like, I thought he was cool. And I started hanging out with him, and his mom was like a punk, was like an old punk rocker actually. And I remember like he played me Dead Kennedys and something else at his crib. But anyway, he was teaching me a lot of shit about drums, and he took me to he told me about a show. It was like Ill Repute. So my first show was in Florida. It was Ill Repute, but it was like when they were like super corny. Like I bought an LP, an Ill Repute LP from the show, and I remember it was called Big Rusty Balls, and it was so so fucking whack, but I thought it was cool at the time because I was a kid. And I don't remember anything about it except for they were like on the cover, they're sitting on like a bunch of like big wrecking balls.
I'm trying to remember. I think that's on Bad. Is it on Bad Taste Records that put it out?
No, I think it's on Doctor Strange.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I vaguely remember the cover.
Yeah. The vinyl was like, you know, like the clear vinyl with like all the strikes of like different colors. Like,
yeah.
It was like that, which I thought was fucking dope.
Yeah, it's still an awesome.
There was like
color
two
vinyl.
Covers too. There was two covers. Tom Petty, American Girl, and
just Bob, what you want to hear Ill Repute too.
Yeah, and Bob Marley, Don't Worry About a Thing.
Everything's gonna be all right.
Yeah, so like, so the real dope era of Ill Repute. But it's cool to be able to say that, like, you know, a fucking. You know, my first show was an old school band, you know,
yeah,
so
exactly.
It sounds cool, but it was fucking whack. And then, like, that was the only show I went to in Florida, and then soon after I moved to Wilkes-Barre, and then it took me a little bit to, like, find friends who were into music, and then to get an older kid to drive to a show. And then I remember, like, one of my first shows was, I don't know, there was this local band, Bedford. They're like fucking, dude, I don't even know how to describe, like, they were like the shit in the Wilkes-Barre scene. Like,
okay.
They were like the fucking coolest dudes, but they were like, I don't even know how to, it wasn't hardcore. They called it like nerdcore. Their thing was like being nerds, and they were straight edge. The drummer was this dude, Ed Gita, and he had this zine called Refuge Fanzine.
Okay. I don't even remember that.
He had rep. He like people know about him, and they actually put on. He was like one of the main dudes who put on the Wilkes-Barre Fest, which was like kind of a big deal, like in the mid '90s before like Posse Numbers days in Wilkes-Barre. But anyway, yeah. So like probably like a fucking whack Bedford show, but some early shows I remember in Wilkes-Barre was like Both Worlds.
Okay. Oh wow. Like the Cro-Mags.
Yeah. What? Yeah, when like the first 10-inch came out, like I knew what Cro-Mags was. I knew what like Sick of It All was, and like on the flyer it was like, you know, featuring members of Cro-Mags and Sick of It All and this and that. I was like, yo, we gotta go to this show. So we went to that, and I remember seeing like some shit like No Redeeming Social Value and some other stuff like that. But
what
then,
was the vibe like at those shows in Wilkes-Barre? Because I know that stuff, you know, kind of had a heavier vibe in the mid '90s in New York, certainly.
Yeah. Well, Wilkes-Barre was two scenes that was like kind of divided. There was like the Wilkes-Barre straight edge scene, which was like emo dudes, which was like the Bedford crew, and they were all straight edge and they were all super political. Every fucking week they'd be like boycotting some different fucking company, and they'd like, you know, I was like 14 years old or 15, and they'd, you know, give me a flyer about, yeah, don't buy Frito-Lay products because of fucking Vietnam or whatever.
Was it Was it New Bedford Fest that they put on?
No. New Bedford Fest was in New Bedford, Connecticut, I think.
Oh, Connecticut, sorry, yeah.
This was in Wilkes-Barre, and later on there was a Posse Numbers Fest.
Yeah, no, I definitely know Posse Numbers, but I'm trying to
remember. It was like Wilkes-Barre. Kingston Fire Hall, and like it was like shit like Get Up Kids, Converge, who else?
Probably His Hero's Gone.
Yeah, His Hero's Gone, Braid,
Drop Dead, like Dillinger Four. Yeah. I think I might have been at one of those.
The most like famous thing that happened at one of those fests was, remember that being Coalesce?
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Yeah, Coalesce, like the drummer like threw his like drum and it like his bass drum and it like hit a girl in the head. Like that was like the big thing.
Yeah. Totally remember when that happened.
But the shit was like fucking so stupid. Like the one fest they like flew over a Tibetan monk and like had everybody like sit on the floor while he like played one of those fucking one of those joints, and like, yeah, it's not stupid as
no,
in like
I know.
Tibetan monk stupid, but like the thing about it was these dudes made all this big stink, like they were like, you know, they were gonna change the world, like all this like making like the young kids like, I don't know, think they were the shit because of that kind of stuff. And the dudes like didn't really give a fuck about hardcore or like punk in the end, and because of it, like Wilkes-Barre, like that era, like doesn't have one fucking record to its name, like doesn't have one. You know what I'm saying? Like it was just all bullshit. It was just all like their ego. Like really, when
that was
I look
the thing
at
about that time, you know, like it wasn't necessarily like the politics were kind of like right on, but it was definitely like a lot of times it was about people's egos. In service of politics.
Yeah, I'm not saying like their politics were wrong. Like, you know, it's all, I'm sure, you know, it was all the right causes at the right time, but I don't know if
it was lost a lot of times on the audience too.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, so there was that crowd. And so all those shows were in Wilkes-Barre that were at like fire halls and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then there was the quote unquote CC's crowd. So there was like a club in Music, PA called CC's. Mm-hmm. And like every New York hardcore band and every Victory band, shit like Life of Agony, all those bands would go through there. And that like where like the tough guy shit would go down. So I was though, and both of those scenes kind of hated each other and didn't fuck each other, and just like, you know, for no real reason, it was just, you know, dumb shit. But I was young enough to where I didn't care. Like I was friends with both of those groups of people. They were, you know, way older than me, so I would go, you know, to a Wilkes-Barre show on Friday night and see like something like Great or whatever was popping at that time, and like some like dudes rolling on the ground and whatever, and then Saturday night go to Music and see like Strife or Sick of It All or whatever playing up there, like Warzone. Like I saw Warzone twice there. Like, so, you know,
did you ever see Steve Aoki's band?
What
was his band called?
Yaphet Kotto.
Was he in Yaphet Kotto?
I want to say he was.
No, because wasn't that Casey's band, Yaphet Kotto?
He wasn't in it with them?
No, I don't think so. Well, now we got to check this.
Yeah, I don't know.
When you said Cry on the Ground, I remember a video of him, and they were like, and he was like doing the spaz out on the ground thing, which was a very popular move in the 90s.
I was in a spaz out on the ground band.
I like some of them. Like, I like, you know.
Me too.
Were in it one, though?
Yeah, I played drums in one. I wasn't an original member, but the dude who put on Posse Numbers Fest, Bob Mack, who used to be like a real close friend of mine, he was the singer, and it was like that kind of shit. Like I was playing drums, but I wasn't, you know, you know, these dudes would be rolling around, and I'd be like, yo, this is crazy. I'd have like a 10-yard fight shirt on or whatever, but it was, I like Frail and some of that stuff, so... So I'm not totally dissing rolling on the floor core.
I remember Grade had this roadie Sean Moe, and he didn't like any kind of music other than like Rev Youth Crew.
Yeah.
That was it. And he was amazing because he'd be doing merch for them and kids would come up and be like, yeah, can I get that shirt in a medium? And he'd be like, what's Rev number 6? The kid would be like, I don't know. And he'd be like, then you can't really get that shirt, can you? Just like total asshole, like hating on the band you're working
for. Dude, it's funny because like that era, that shit, like Rev and all that stuff, New York stuff, that stuff may have never existed because they like no one ever told me about that shit. No one ever like of that, like, you know, when those people were like my old heads, like, you know, that's something like they didn't care about. They didn't pass that stuff down. They cared about like Los Crudos and, you know, that kind of shit.
I love Los Crudos too, but yeah, it's like it's weird because that Rev period, it was just kind of prior to even Rev catching on to that stuff was good and that people wanted it. And so the only way you'd find that was like a lost and found bootleg or some other like.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Because a lot of it wasn't even in print.
No.
I remember like even like definitely like stuff like Straight Ahead and shit like that. Like,
well, that's still not in print.
Yeah, exactly.
Craig Sitari has been telling me he's been going to do the reissue since I was like 14. I remember asking him about it because he used to do the cover of Straight Ahead and he'd be like, yeah, I'm going to reissue it. And, you know, and I remember being on tour with him 2 years ago and asking him, he's like, yeah, it's going to come out one day.
No comment on that stuff, dude.
It was hard to get all that stuff. Like the chain, I remember the Chain of Strength thing didn't get reissued to like what, 97, 98?
Yeah, yeah. I remember I had that on cassette.
Yeah, like the only way to get it would be someone taping it for you or something.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I'm trying to think of like when I got stuff. Like there was this place in Wilkes-Barre called Musical Energi. Mm-hmm. It's still there.
What a great name.
Yeah, it was like ENERGI. And back then it had dope stuff. It had a lot of good tapes. Like I got like both like Warzone cassettes, like the Don't Forget the Struggle and Open Your Eyes, and then I got like NYHC the way it is, Calm.
Whoa.
Like stuff like that on cassette for like $3 or $4, because there used to be like a pretty big like skinhead contingent in Wilkes-Barre like in the 80s and like in the early 90s, so like all that stuff was probably from them. And I got like, I remember I got like the set, like Cro-Mags Best Wishes LP from there. And I didn't know, like, I knew that there was a good, like 90s dudes. Like one thing I do remember, like, I want to say this one, I forget what dude told me, but some older Wilkes-Barre dude told me that like one Cro-Mags record is whack or good. And then the rest of them are whack, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, damn, I don't know if this is the good one. And it was Best Wishes. And like, to my like fucking 15-year-old ears, it was like garbage. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, God, what are they, like, they're saying about God? Like, what are they, like a Christian band? I was like, this shit sucks, you know? Now, like, dude, like Best Wishes is almost better than Age of Quarrel to me now. But I just like, kids don't understand, like in that era, like there was so much, like, not era, but like before the, any time before the internet now, like or at least the internet the way it is, there's so much trial and error.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And, you know, you would spend like $15 on a CD and it might have sucked, but like you just spent $15 on it. So you would like kind of force yourself to like it. And there's still stuff that I have like a soft spot for from when I was in high school that I know isn't technically good or acceptable by like the fucking cool guys, but I don't care. I still like it.
Was that Youth Crew Revival stuff kind of happening there, like Rain on the Parade? Were they coming up at that point, or
that shit was like Youth Crew Revival? We didn't care about that in Wilkes-Barre until the Holy Trinity of Youth Crew Revival. Floor Punch in My Eyes and 10 Yard Fight.
Yeah. 10 Yard Fight though was kind of ahead by 2 or 3 years, right? Like,
yeah.
I remember like at one point it almost seemed like I remember going to see, I was on tour with the Swarm roadieing and they played in Worcester and 10 Yard Fight was like on before Bane. And I remember thinking like, whoa, Bane is like the more popular of the, and that was when Bane, before the first LP, so when Bane was still kind of part of the Youth Crew revival more, I guess. But yeah, yeah, no, like, it
Bane
seemed like
definitely like the first two 7-inches were like not lumped in, but they were definitely in like the old school straight edge scene.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, no, you're right. Like those, that was like the when Equal Vision put out the floor punch and the 10-yard fight, it was on. That was that's when it hit Toronto. And when I say hit Toronto, at least six of us bought those CDs.
Wilkes-Barre, man, it hit us heavy, man.
Like, yeah,
you would have to take a sledgehammer to my Paz top to crinkle that that fucking bad boy, man. Everybody had Paz tops. Everybody had fucking cuffed jeans, New Balance 574s, the whole deal, man. It was like we were fucking about it.
Did you ever have you had a varsity jacket, I assume?
I did not have a varsity jacket, no. Oh. I don't know why. Because you know what? This is why I never had a varsity jacket. I thought they were ill, but I never actually got them. But I was like – I was also super into hip-hop at that time.
Okay, yeah.
Like super into hip-hop. So like – you know, I had like Tommy Hilfiger gear and like polo jackets and shit like that. So, I had to like, I like fucking dabbled in both swags.
Where'd you get into hip hop? Where was that influence from?
I don't know, man. Like, I've been into hip hop since I was like a little kid. Like, my first tape ever, I don't know if I got Fat Boys or Beastie Boys first, but that kind of shit. And like, I was just like super into it from then on. Like, so and in the 90s at that time, like, there was like a big, like, underground hip hop scene. Like,
the Ruckus Records.
Yeah, Ruckus Records in New York. And I used to like take the Martz bus. That's like the bus company in Wilkes-Barre, Martz. I used to take the Martz bus to New York alone to go to Fat Beats to buy like fucking 12 inches. And shit like that.
Bootlegs and mixtapes, I think.
Bootlegs, like super shitty, like bootlegs of old 12 inches and fucking mixtapes and all that shit.
So, like, were you, like, when you say you went to these shows by yourself, like, that was always something you kind of just did? Like, you never really found anyone that was as, like, minded, I guess, to
first of all,
progressive that way?
The first wigger of my Northwest area junior through senior high school was Bob Mac McCullough of Posse Numbers fame. He was literally the first wigger ever in that high school. Yeah. And he was like how many years older than me? Maybe 3 years older than me. And I remember when I first moved there, him and like a couple other wiggers like would like they took me over like, yeah, so you're cool with us here, like blah blah blah. And like the one dude Gary Moore like took me over to his locker. He's like, yeah, check this out. And he took out a Dixie cup full of soil with one single sprout. He's like, yeah, I'm growing weed in my locker, yo. so he told me that like before I came there, there was like the big thing was like Hicks versus Wiggers, because like Hicks were like our like not jocks, like Hicks were
like the normals,
the sort of. There was like normals that are Hicks to like fucking any normal person's standards, but real Hicks, like they were like poser Hicks. Like there was dudes that would like buy like Chippewa boots, which are like the expensive like farmer boots, and they did not live on a farm. They don't know how to drive a John Deere, and they would like take the boots and like rub them in the mud and
posing.
There was poser Hicks. That's how much being a Hick was popping in my high school. So I remember Bob Mack told me like that for some like assembly or whatever, like they got to do like presentations, and the Hicks in his class had a group called Hawn, Hicks against white N-words.
Wow.
And it didn't get shut down. Like that was allowed to, they were allowed to go on stage, and they made like a wigger diss like rap. So these dudes would like, so first of all,
did you ever watch WCW in the 90s, like wrestling?
Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't that sound like Mr. Perfect's crew that did the Rap Is Crap song? Like against Conan and the Filthy Animals?
Yeah, there was. They may have been influenced by that. By that, I'm sure those dudes dabbled in professional wrestling.
Pro wrestling. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah. So yeah. Like, as far as like urban music and dance music and all that kind of stuff, where I went to high school, I straight up, like, I only had one friend, and he wasn't even in my grade. He was a grade ahead of me. Jeff Kashner, and he was super into hip hop. And he went to college in Wilkes-Barre, like, when I was a senior, and he had like a college radio show, and we were into DJing together and like kind of like taught each other how to DJ and stuff. And like I would go up and DJ, you know, spin on the radio with him and stuff. So like, yeah, so it was. There wasn't too many people into hip hop. There was like, you know, some like basketball players that I was homies with that were into like Bad Boy or like Tupac, like Above the Rim soundtrack. But they didn't know about, like, you know, they weren't like buying the Source magazine and shit like that like I was. So
when did you first get into, like, were you collecting all genres of records? Because I know you collected records. You still collect records, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, for sure.
Like, but like, when did you first like seriously get into collecting records? Like, were you collecting every genre? Because, like, I think I was, like, trying at that point to buy, like, I would buy my Ruckus records 12 inches, and I would buy, you know, my punk records, too. But, like, you know, there came a point where I just focused on buying punk records, I guess.
On punk. I was, like, I was, like, really into DJing. So I, like, wanted to be able to, like, try to like see that I could DJ like every genre of DJ music. So so I had to have like a little collection of house, progressive house, drum and bass,
jungle probably.
jungle. I had a fucking dope jungle collection. I really wish I still had it. Fucking electro, you know, hip hop, funk, all that stuff. So I spent like a lot of money on records. And then like once I was in like youth crew mode, I needed a Project X. I needed a the first Youth of Today 7-inch. I needed a Together 7-inch. So I was spending all my money on records. And my uncle owned a landscaping company, and I worked for him in high school and like a little bit after high school, and I would just spend all that money on vinyl. And what people don't understand about like DJing at that time is like I was super into drum and bass and even like house music. That's all imports.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a 12-inch on 40 that would play at 45. So you'd have one song on one side and one song on the other side. That's no less than $10.
And were you going out and trying to get DJ gigs at this point too?
Nah, not really. I didn't know how, I didn't know where. I didn't really start getting DJ gigs until I moved to Philly.
Yeah. So I guess at this point, like the youth crew stuff, like starts happening and that becomes your focus. Like, what is that? Like 98, 97, 90.
Yeah. Yeah. 97, 98. Yeah.
And so, what were the local bands at that point? Magnus, was that not, or that later?
Yeah, Magnus was around. I wasn't in Magnus at first.
No, but you're pictured on the back of the 7-inch singing along, right?
No, I played on the 7-inch. I'm actually wearing a Ruckus Records t-shirt while playing in the picture.
Oh, that's it. And Alex is singing along.
Yeah, Alex is singing along. That's Alex was in Magnus at the end. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's like just in the crowd at that point singing along.
Yeah, yeah.
He was and dancing Magnus too, right?
Or yeah, no? Dan sang for Magnus, yeah.
So I guess like how'd you meet Dan? Would you just kind of meet Dan and Alex and all these people like just in the scene, more or less?
Yeah. Dan was older than us. And he like put on a lot of shows. It took me like a while to get really into Magnus, like because Dude, it's really weird because I forgot about this until
now.
They
were like a religious band, right? Or something?
No, no, they weren't a religious band.
I thought there was something about them like that, but I'm
No, there was nothing like that. But there was still like, I was still like kind of like had like a 1 foot in that like PC like world. So like when Magnus came out, like those dudes, like the guitar player dudes, like Jesse and Jody, they were like fucking dickheads and like said bitch and stuff, you know, like
yeah.
stuff like that, which yeah. was like, you know, crazy then, you know, like
they were early adopters of the reactionary scene that kind of came really
sort
popular.
Of, but they were just like regular dudes, like yeah. those dudes like didn't know really know much about hardcore or anything. They just, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
they were like, you know, they were like fucking girls and like, you know, doing, they were straight edge, but they were like, I don't know, just like the opposite of like fucking nerdy, sit in your room listening to Chokehold core. Like, you know, like I don't know how to put it. So like, it took me a while. Like, these guys are dickheads. Like, they're not like PC or whatever. And the same thing like with Floor Punch too. Like, Floor Punch demo, like, I don't know if it was like that up there, but like, people like didn't fuck with Floor Punch for a while, like where I was from.
I think it was after the demo. It was after the Duncan Barlow incident. It was when yeah. it became like really not cool to like Floor Punch for a lot of people. And it was like, for me, it was like, but I love the music. Like, I just can't, how do I reconcile this? And it was like, also, it was like you could get away with liking Floor Punch. One Life Crew, there's no way. If you were caught liking One Life
Dude,
Crew.
I literally had the One Life Crew CD taken out of my hands in the Gallery of Sound in Wilkes-Barre Mall by this dude, Jay Hudock. He literally took it out of my hands and said, nah, man, you're not buying that.
Yeah, yeah.
And put it down. But I like decided I liked Floor Punch early on because I remember I read a review of the demo in Effect fanzine, mm-hmm. and it said something about like questionable lyrics or something, or I don't know. And I bought the demo off of somebody at CC's for like $3, and I was like, I don't care, this is the shit. Like,
is there questionable lyrics on the demo?
Something about like just like how it was like violent, like,
oh, and in Effect fanzine is calling something out for being violent too.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I don't. It's cloudy. Like, maybe like it was something else. You know what? I think I think it said like the lyrics like were like repetitive or something. But it was somewhere else said that the lyrics were like violent or something. But I don't know. There was just a turning point where I was like, you know what? Fuck all that shit. Like, who cares? Like, you know, I hang out with like skater dudes that are like from the movie Kids. Like, they, you know, like, I don't know.
Way worse than.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm listening to like this music, like hip hop, that's like literally only about like the stuff that like the hardcore I listen to is like against. Like, I don't know. Who am I? To, you know? So I was just like, fuck it.
Yeah. So I guess at that point, you kind of like, when did you start playing in bands kind of more seriously? You joined Magnus and play on the 7-inch. Was that your first kind of like band that made it beyond the demo stage, I guess?
Yeah, definitely.
What was your first band that put out a tape?
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
Well, I was in the scream, the roll around on the floor screamo band.
What was it called?
It was called Our Time.
Okay. And to be confused with the other Our Time. Isn't there another Carl Cadova? Didn't he have a band called Our Turn? Oh, no, it was Our Turn.
Our Turn, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I apologize.
Yeah. Come on, man. Get your hours. Like Our Gang, Our Turn, Our Time.
Our War.
There's another Our Time.
Our War.
Our War, yeah. The only thing that they ever put out, they put out like, I think, two demos, a split 7-inch with some band from like Rochester or something. And we were on this like weird comp that I don't even know how we got on it, but it was a CD comp that had something to do with like Satan or Charles Manson or something. And I remember like, I'm pretty sure there's like a Psy Warfare song on it.
Whoa, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what it's called though. I don't have one. I thought about it like a few months ago and looked it up, and it's on Discogs and stuff. But yeah, but the first thing that I was on that you know was definitely Magnus, that 7-inch.
Yeah. So how did you join Magnus? Were they just like a band you had seen and?
Yeah, and I eventually like became friends with them, and I don't even remember like why their drummer quit or whatever. I think he might have moved or broke edge or something. I don't know. But yeah, so I started playing with them, and I cared about like Youth Crew style hardcore like more than pretty much anybody in the band. So like I started helping with songwriting, and I like wrote all the lyrics on the fucking 7-inch pretty much and stuff like that. So
and so what's your next kind of like after you guys break up, what did you kind of next do? I guess at that point Posse Numbers is kind of starting too, right?
Yeah.
Or a couple years later?
Yeah, Posse Numbers was a couple years later. I don't really remember. I'm horrible at timelines, really. So I don't really remember. Like I know at some point I moved to New York for a year and went to audio engineering school. And then I moved back. I don't know. And then I moved back for maybe like a year, and then I moved to Philadelphia with a bunch of friends, and I played drums in that band Horror Show for a little bit.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, like after their CD and stuff came out, I played like a couple shows with them, and then got kicked out because their one guitar player like didn't like me or something. And then I played. I was an official member of Blacklisted for like a week. I played a show with them, and then like, I don't know. I couldn't. They were like going into tour mode, and I think I like couldn't like really didn't want to do that rigorous tour life, you know. So,
Cold World's kind of your first real like other than the Magnus, I guess, band.
Yeah, yeah. No, I wouldn't. I don't know if I'd consider Magnus a real band, but yeah, yeah. Cold World's definitely my first real deal band.
So at which point do you start conceiving? Because that's the thing about Cold World, like conceptually, you know, playing in Fucked Up, we get a lot of credit for conceptual kind of stuff with this band, but like nothing on Cold World. Like Cold World kind of came out, maybe not from the very first 7-inch, but definitely by the second. Well, I guess the first 7-inch got fucked up so much with the release and everything, but by the second 7-inch, there was just like such a, everything about it, like such a defined aesthetic in like, you know, sound and in visuals and things like that. Like, when did you kind of conceive that all like
what it was going to be?
Yeah.
I don't even know. Like I said, man, I'm blurry with like details and stuff, but I think it was just like, I remember like hardcore being like fucking boring. Like since like, I don't know, like the last like big things were like American Nightmare. And then there was like, well, I don't know what came first, Riot Brigade or American Nightmare, I guess.
Riot Brigade.
Yeah, so like
Riot. That demo, Riot, yeah.
Yeah, so like there was the Youth Crew thing that had a big effect on us. Riot Brigade had a big effect on the Wilkes-Barre kids. American Nightmare had everybody like fucking buying Diesel jeans and Adidas track tops and like fucking Adidas sneakers and shit like that. And then like No Warning had everybody trying to be like fucking skinhead rats from the Lower East Side skanking. And then
I guess Mental too after that.
Yeah, Mental. And then shit got like fucking boring, man. And shit was just boring. So we were just like, yo, like, let's just try to do something like listenable. Like that was like what was big for me and Alex. Like something that like, because, you know, we love hardcore and stuff, but, like, we weren't the kind of guys that if we were, like, driving to the mall, we'd put hardcore on, you know? So we were like, let's make a fucking band that, like, you could listen to while you're going to fucking buy some Air Force Ones. Like, you know what I mean? So, like, the thing that we could think of was, like, Roadrunner, kind of like, you know, cross, you know, second era crossover style stuff, and kind of try to put some melody in there. And I don't know, I remember, like, we had songs written, and I was like, yo, like, this part here, like, instead of putting a guitar part, like, solo or whatever, like, trust me, just leave it blank. So we'd record the song, like, while practicing. Uh-huh. And then I took the tape home, put it into, like, the left channel of my DJ mixer, and then, like, did cuts over it and recorded it and then sent it to everybody. I was like, yo, like, this is going to sound crazy, but, like, listen to this. You know, like, what do you think? And they're like, yo, this is crazy and it's stupid, but fuck it. Let's do it. You know? And so then that's – and we didn't, like, think, like, yo, let's have this hip-hop aesthetic and stuff like that. Like, we didn't – I don't know. I think it was just, like, Dan doesn't know how to make a design or come up with an idea for a shirt. Alex – was in college at the time, and he didn't have time to think about that shit. And it was just like, that's what I was about at that time. That's like all I really cared about was hip hop and stuff like that. So it's just like naturally, oh, I have to make a t-shirt design. Okay. Like Strong City Records logo, you know, just like stuff like that. We don't have covers for our first 7-inch yet. It's been almost a year since it's been out. I'll just scan pictures of the lowlife from these old Source magazines and use that as the cover. Like, I wasn't thinking, it wasn't a plan. It was just what I was into and just kind of happened naturally, I guess. It definitely wasn't contrived at all.
So did you have a demo first, or did you go right to the 7-inch?
Yeah, we went right to the 7-inch. I think we, like, I made a CDR with maybe like two songs from the 7-inch.
Okay.
That we just like gave out to friends. But yeah, we didn't have a demo.
Yeah, because it was so weird because that 7-inch, I guess Walk All Night had the first Cold World 7-inch, that Blacklisted demo 7-inch, and there was something else that was like
people. Think I Care.
The Think I Care.
Yeah.
Everyone just kind of like, you know, obviously was flipping out for trying to get at that point.
A Canadian band too, right?
Final Word.
Final Word, yeah.
From Montreal, absolutely, yeah. And I guess it was just like, and it was so many labels at that point got in the situation where like there were these records that people all wanted. Mm-hmm. But there would just be constant fuck ups, and then this thing never came out. So I don't know, like maybe it was different for you guys, but it seemed to me almost by the time I'd seen you guys on the first 7-inch and bought a copy of it. But it seems like the second 7-inch was what really kind of came out and was widely distributed and people kind of took up on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I wouldn't say the first 7-inch went under the radar, but.
No, but sorry.
I think it like didn't, like, it definitely. It wasn't like as turnt up as, like you said, as, well, you didn't use those words.
I was going to, you cut me off.
Yeah. I don't know what it was, but yeah, the first 7-inch kind of hinted at what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. So it didn't like start like the mania, like the second 7-inch did. And also the second 7-inch was on Locking Out, and like, Locking Out was still like popping at that time. So that helped.
I would actually say you say Locking Out's still popping at that time. I think Locking Out is almost like the Youth Attack of a different style of hardcore. Mm-hmm. Like Greg Mental, much like, you know, from Charles Bronson, Mark McCoy.
Mark McCoy, yeah.
Is like this guy who's like going to be a perennial tastemaker, you know? Yeah. Like Locking Out still puts out stuff and people like freak out, you know? It's just like... It's always just had that aesthetic and that kind of vibe. But like you guys, yeah, like that 7-inch. I remember being in Bob Shedd's car and he played it for me. And he's like, oh, have you seen that band Cold World? And I'm like, yeah, I saw him before. It was cool, but, you know, whatever. And then he played it and it just like my jaw dropped. And it was like, and it was this weird thing because it was at first it was, I don't know if it was a reaction that I loved it the very first listen, you know, like it was like just like taken aback. And then, like, and then I, you know, shortly thereafter fell in love with it and stuff. But like, there was like a, it seems like there was this, like, a real division when people heard the band. Like, you either loved it or you were just like, I hate this band. What was it like playing live? Was everyone on board when you guys played live, more or less?
There were, like, I remember playing shows where, like, the dude, Colin of Arabia from, like, he was, like, putting on shows in Brockton. And I remember, like, being scared to go there and play because he was, like, I remember him, like, dissing us. Like, I was like, damn, this dude, like, is tough and he hates us. He's going to, like, beat us up on stage or whatever. And I remember us, like, playing at this place, the Tiger's Den, and halfway through him, like, kind of, like, you know, like, mad, you know, like, not, like, you know, like, not even acknowledging us. And then halfway through the set, like, literally singing along and knew every word somehow. So, like, I was like, all right, cool. When he's like, I like that dude. He's cool with us still. But, like, there was definitely, like, people had, like a misconception of I remember, like, people didn't believe that we were hardcore kids. People, you know, I don't know, like, you know what, honestly, like,
nu metal was the slag that I heard a lot.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, well, I mean, dude, like, think about this. Think about being in a band where you've never seen anything written about your band in the quote unquote press that didn't have the words Limp Bizkit in it.
Yeah.
Like, think about that. Like,
yeah.
So there's, like, you know.
But it's so weird because it's like I look at it almost as like Cold World's the other side of that Limp Bizkit coin. Whereas if you tastefully integrated influences from hip hop into aggressive music, what would happen as opposed to untastefully doing it, you know, like, but it you know, it's something that, like, you know, like, I guess if people, like, I remember actually the first time I heard No Warning, they had this song, I'm trying to remember what song it was, on Ill Blood, and it had kind of like a rappy beat, and I'm like, oh, this is like a nu metal song.
Yeah, the song, like, with Porter, where Porter does the bust.
The bust. And it's like, and they're like, and DeLong's like, actually, it's like a breakdown rip. And I'm like, oh, my bad. Like, I guess if you don't know the history and lineage and you're just coming at it, like, with, like, sort of like an untrained ear, you'd be like, oh, this sounds like this, you know? We're like, I guess that shit never fazed you, though, because there were people that were kind of getting it, and people getting it from, like, weird corners, like people from, like, the crust world kind of getting on board.
That's, like, my favorite thing about Cold World is that, like, people like you and, you know, like, people from that, like, that scene that I kind of always, like, I don't know, like, I never fully got into, but, like, kind of, like, basically, like, the fucking having shows on top of, like, bicycle shops scene.
Yeah.
You know, like, that, like, has, like, something that I think is dope, but for some reason I never, like, fully immersed myself in, like, I did, like, the normal core scene. Like, those, like, people that I, like, respect from that scene, like, reached out to us, and, like, that's, like, my favorite thing about Cold World, and I don't know what it is that you know what I'm saying? That doesn't happen often, but it's definitely something that I appreciate, and kind of, like, makes me not hate Cold World.
Well, like, you know, like, it's funny that you say that, but, like, is it, like, do you think almost, like, you need, because I feel the same way with Fucked Up sometimes. It's almost like until you get that almost external validation from somewhere you never expect it, you're almost like, is it valid what I'm doing? You know, like, when it's someone, like, you're like, oh, wow, you, who I didn't think would appreciate this at all, like it, it just kind of reinforces that, like, oh, wow, this is maybe got some merit to it at a certain point.
I mean, I'm, like, the hardest dude to get to, like, I still haven't accepted that Cold World or will think that Cold World is any good. Like, it's hard for me to, like, talk about that kind of stuff. So I don't know.
Well, I'm not going to force you to talk about that stuff, but I do want to ask you about, I want to ask you, about this, the craziest tour I think I ever heard was, like, a weekend, and it was you guys, Sexfit, and Iron Age. And
I was not on that.
Did you do that weekend though? Was that a weekend?
I think they did a weekend, or I think they did like a whole week with Iron Age without me, and Sexvid may have
done
been
some
on
shows.
It.
Yeah, you didn't go on that tour.
No one else in Cold World knows what Sexvid is, so they could have played, and no one would know. So you know,
but you guys did a lot of shows. Sorry.
I didn't do that tour because I got a real job at that time. So I quote unquote real job. That's the thing with Cold World. It's like the whole in its whole existence, we were like seeing our friends' bands like Blacklisted and stuff, like going the full on touring route. And we just like never committed to that and had a lot of like internal quarrel as to like whether we should or not, and like it would always be like everybody's down to do it except for this person, and then now that person's down but now this guy can't do it. So in that time I was the guy who couldn't do it, so there was some tours and stuff that I wasn't on, and that was one of them.
Did you guys go tour a lot with Iron Age, right? Or played like a bunch of shows? Is there like some crazy story where you guys go to like some frat house party and there's a giant brawl and someone, an emo kid, pulls a gun on you guys?
Yeah, I wasn't there though. I don't remember if I wasn't at the party or if I wasn't on the tour at all.
I think you were on that tour because this would have been really kind of early-ish.
Yeah, like anything on the road that happens after the show, if there's any chance that I can go somewhere and sit in a room with an iPod and or a book or a magazine and not talk to anyone, that is what's going down. And dudes like Haroon and Alex or whatever are going to be going to find these house parties where they get guns pulled on them by rednecks or whatever. I want nothing to do with that. I, like, you know, I'm not that dude. I like fucking DJing and stuff, but like, I to this day watch a lot of anime and was a virgin until I was 21. Like that, I'm not about that life, so I miss out on those kind of things.
Well, this explains, I guess, your Skype image is not just for aesthetic purposes now that you say the anime thing.
No, my Skype image, I forgot what it is.
It's like a manga. It looks like a manga.
Oh yeah,
panel.
That's the artist who did like Akira. He did something for Comme des Garçons. So that's.
So a meeting of two worlds for you, I guess.
Yeah, it's a meeting of two embarrassing, nerdy worlds.
That's, I guess, the other thing is, like, you've always been super up kind of on male fashion. Like, certainly on a streetwear level, but, like, are you just into male – are you into fashion in general?
I'm a dedicated follower of fashion.
Yeah?
No.
Dude, I watched fashion television. I don't know if you guys had that in America, but that was a Canadian show – where they would weekly kind of do rundowns of like what happened in fashion each week.
Nah, I would watch that though.
It was amazing. Like, I wish it was on now.
We had a House of Style with Steve Crawford and what was the other dude?
Not nearly as good. Like, not nearly as good. I've seen House of Style too, and trust me, like Jeannie Becker on fashion television. Like they were doing runways in Paris, my friend. I just like it before, you know, we can wrap up pretty soon and stuff. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Cold World merch phenomena, and stuff like that. Well, what do you think? Have you ever kept track? And like, because you guys were never, I don't think, very serious about your merch as much as the people buying it were.
That's very true.
But did you ever keep track on the most shirts you ever sold in one day?
No.
Because I remember playing with you guys, and this bleeds into the next thing I want to talk about, when we opened up for the Cro-Mags and Dom did the show in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And we played to – it was a sold-out show. We played to like a half-full room because everyone else was lined up to get a Cold World shirt or two or three at that show.
Yeah.
So there must have been like a multitude of shirts sold at that show. What do you think it was about your guys' merch? Like, why? How did you guys figure it out so much better than most bands? Like, was it just like knowing about that streetwear stuff or knowing what people wanted to wear at that point?
Nah, man, it's the opposite of that. It was not fucking caring about it. And then, like, the reason we had a different shirt at every show was because we didn't believe that people were going to buy them. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. Like, at that time, like, I was the only fucking person that I've ever seen wear fucking Bathing Ape to a show. Like, I'm the only person that I knew who, like, fucking moshed in, like, a Gucci shoes or fuck something stupid like that. So I didn't know that anyone would know what that was or be. So why would I think someone would want to buy that if I put it on my design? Mm-hmm. It's just what I was into at the time. So, and I don't know why people went crazy for it. I do know that we made a small numbers, like, you know, whatever band was out that was fucking on tour, living off their band, and they made a shirt that had their name with a skull and a spade with blood splatter. They're like, yeah, print 3,000 of those. We're good. We were literally making 40 t-shirts.
Yeah.
Like, we'd make one design, 40, like 50 was crazy to me. I was like, 50? What? Like, I don't know. Like, there's 50 people are going to want to buy this. Like, I don't know that 50 people fucking want a Diamond D in the Psychotic Neurotics ripoff t-shirt. So, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I think it was just kind of that where, like, we made, like, a little amount and people just, like, we happened to be popular at the time, so people wanted to make sure that they got one.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of stuck to that where I just, like, wanted to keep making a new shirt for each show. And even now, like, that's still how I do it. Like, I like doing it. And that's actually what got me, my job, is that my homie was, you know, thought what we did was cool and, you know, just like trusted my, you know, intuition with that kind of shit and just brought me on board.
So at this point, like, how do you kind of keep up on stuff that's going on? Like, do you still like, are you just like kind of like constantly digging for like source stuff or like different books or like, you know, it just seems like the world's a lot more accessible now, you know? And it just
I mean, that's the thing, man. Like, shit's so like stuff that I've been into since I was a teenager, like that I like, I'll see like someone do like a flyer or something that has a picture on it. I'm like, I know who designed this flyer. I will bet all of my fucking Japanese punk records that this dude does not know what this, you know, drawing or picture is from, who made this fucking thing. He saw it on Tumblr and fucking dragged it to his desktop, which is fine. Like, that's like the fucking, that's the world we're in now. But it's just, it is easier to like fucking pose and to do shit like that. But I don't know. I just, even still, what's funny to me about like kids these days is it just seems like with all of the information at their fingertips, like the fucking less they even know or want to or care. Like, so it's a weird like double-edged sword where like, people like me or you use that we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I remember us having a conversation about this. Mm-hmm. Just using that resource to fucking, you know, go even further on our nerdiness. And, you know, but that it just because information is everywhere and fucking readily available and free doesn't change people's mindset. It doesn't make someone a nerd. It doesn't make someone want to sit down and wade through it, you know? So
it's harder though to be, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I would say it's harder though to be focused now, I think, for like, if I was a younger person getting into something, you know, like it'd be hard to kind of like do that natural progression where you kind of like, you're into Discharge and then someone's like, oh, have you heard of these Japanese bands that all sound like Discharge crossed with Motorhead? And then you're like, what? And then you start getting into like, you know, the ones that you can hear about first, like the Gauze and the Gizum and like the band on Auto or the bands on the Puss Zone comp, and, you know, and then you go deeper and deeper. It's like now you can just go as deep as you want. Like, you can get the Typhus Flexi on MP3 as your first record in Japanese punk. You know, it just seems like, and then you can jump immediately and check out like the origins of drill music on YouTube, you know, and just,
yeah, well, that's the thing. Every person is like, you know, yeah, my name's Miranda. I'm a feminist who loves anime and chokehold and twerking and, you know, Chief Keef and Kathleen Hanna. I'm really cool. You know, it's like, what? Like, the people just, like, fucking, as my bandmate Haroon once described, just grabbing everything and just going, honk, honk, honk.
Yeah. But it's like, it's hard not to, because all this stuff is cool.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I can imagine being, like, you know, a 17-year-old person, a kid, and, like, finding out about, like, fucking black metal and, you know, like,
and
everything.
Graffiti. At the same time. And,
like, exactly. Yeah, so it's like fucking hard not to be corny and extremely cross-pollinated these days. And I guess I can't like fucking – I can't diss them. But at the same time, like I think like there's something missing, man, because I hate to like fucking go this route. But as far as like hardcore goes now, like dude, like I – there's like really a big thing missing from, you know, bands could like fine tune their sound like, oh yeah, no, we like really sound like the second Crackdown rehearsal tape that you probably never heard of before, but we have the exact same guitar tone and blah, 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 you know, and we wear, you know, dressed like skinheads and blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but like you're a rich kid from Michigan. Like it doesn't like,
yeah.
You know, like, and your lyrics suck. Like, there's somewhere they're losing something. And I think, like, before where I was saying, like, certain things, like, from the 90s or from when I was growing up, like, that may not, like, fucking, you know, have all, like, the little boxes in the cool tastemakers checklists checked off. Like, they still, like, had, like, some sort of, like, sense of, like, urgency or, like, some kind of heart or atmosphere like that these bands don't have that are coming out now like in this internet era. So I think that's like that's what's lacking in my opinion is like the I don't know like I like if like all like a couple of weeks ago I was watching like Inside Out videos or something on YouTube and like it was like giving me chills you know like everybody like there was something there that like you know is like really like isn't I'm not, and that's the thing. Like, I'm not saying I have it. I'm not saying Cold World is ill or whatever. But definitely, I can't find that feeling in anything going on now.
Which Inside Out was it, by the way?
It wasn't there's the one where like he has this super long speech about like fucking Native Americans and like, but it wasn't that one. I know everyone's gonna think that's the one because there's the one where like he like literally talks for like 15 minutes and he like calls somebody out and the crowd's like, well, what are you gonna do about it, man? Like, are you gonna wipe the single teardrop from the fucking guy's face when he sees, you know, somebody with glitter on the ground? No, you're not doing shit. It wasn't that one. It was some other one, but. It was ill and it like gave me chills and
see, I thought you were
chills watching like fucking wax oiled down like buff dudes in board shorts on stage like doing like fucking 6 foot high jumps and their lyrics aren't about anything and I don't care how fucking tight they are or whatever like there's no fucking feeling in it whatsoever.
I thought you were talking about New York, Inside Out New York for a sec.
No, I'm not one of those fucking dudes. I mean, yo, I'm down with Beat Life. I like Inside Out New York, but fucking the real Inside Out
the
is
real fucking. Inside. Well, speaking about being one of those dudes, Woj, this is the best way we can possibly end this, my friend.
All right.
Because I remember one of the first conversations, actually, I think it was the first conversation you and me ever had, was outside of that show in Baltimore. You had just purchased a bootleg DVD, a video, I believe, actually, at this point, which had Breakdown's amazing Thompson Square Park performance, and also had a Life's Blood live performance. And you had this tape in your hand, and I looked at the tape and I said, "What an amazing tape!" It's like, and you're like, "Yeah, like one of my favorite bands ever." Blah blah blah. Blah. And I'm like, "Yeah, no, it's crazy." And Breakdown set's amazing too. And you're like, oh, "I don't care about Life's Blood." Do you still not care about Life's Blood?
Yo. Life's Blood are super good.
So good.
I admit that. They're like really fucking good. But I didn't get into them at like a crucial point. So it's one of those bands that I like recognize are really ill. And I remember was it like Mike or was it Jonah who had like, dude, I got a Lifeblood like jacket on. He had like a leather jacket with like Lifeblood on the back.
It was probably Jonah, because there's no way Mike would wear a leather jacket with Lifeblood on it. Okay, but I could see Jonah on that weekend at the height of his government warning Richmond, Virginia obsession would definitely be wearing a leather jacket with Lifeblood on it.
Dude, fuck, that was a weird thing going on then. Yeah, somebody in Fucked Up had a Lifeblood, like, fucking, I want to say, like, it was, like, painted, like UK-82 style on the back, like, but, nah, I fuck with Lifeblood, but look, man, like, I can't even remember the last time I, like, put on hardcore on my iPod, and it's not going to be Lifeblood. Put it that way, you know. But no, they're really good and you know, respect.
All right. Well, I guess that Reckoning Force is still just out of reach with you. Nick, I want to have you on again because there's other stories that we didn't get into, and there's like we didn't even talk about LPs or any of that stuff. But thanks, man, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man. It's an honor. When I saw the first, what's the dude from like Beggars Group?
Martin that you Mills.
On? Yeah, like that. I was psyched on that one, man, because I love like 4AD and like, you know, like was he like Stiff Records and shit too? Or
No. He started Beggars Banquet, which then owned 4AD, Don't Fall Off the Mountain, who put out Chrome and Jim Jarmusch's band and Human Sexual Response. Oh, Andy Fell. Have you ever heard the song Andy Fell by Human Sexual Response?
Probably not, no.
Oh, you got to check that out. And also, this label called... I'm going to hit stop recording now.